So for all those who are interested and wanting to know, you are now part of the Senate Committee on Commerce, and we're in session. We have five bills, it looks like, if I'm counting correctly, that are up for today. For all those who are concerned that we're moving all these bills out today, not, because they're all just set for public hearing. So everyone can just be calm, be patient. But we are going to do our bills in a little bit different order just because of the some of them are somewhat related more than others. So what our plan at this point is to start with House Bill 2220. Then we'll go to 2202, and then the chair at this point is planning on opening up a public hearing on the remaining three bills on today's agenda, 2203, 04, and 05, and allow testimony all at once for those three. So with that said, we'll go ahead and open the public hearing on House Bill 2220. Ms. Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2220 regulates pawnbrokers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for such a succinct discussion as to what the measure does. Let's see. I just want to check the relating clause. And, yes, it's true. It does relate to pawnbroker regulations.
Would you like me to go into further detail?
No, thank you.
Okay.
We will now ask. I have only two people signed up for this, and DCBS, David Tatum, and Paul Romaine. Why don't you all two come on up together? And we'll see if anyone else wants to give testimony after y'all finish.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
While they're coming forward, I was distracting our committee staff. I apologize for that, and, for that very brief introduction. And if you'd like her to make a more full introduction, I would appreciate that.
We have the certified smart in front
That's
of us
right.
that will probably set the record.
What are you trying to say?
Me. You're the overwhelming
star. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
That
this is particular the 220.
Right.
2220. I'll stop there and let
thank you.
Others to, let's say, allow me to insert my boot and my foot into my mouth. Okay, who would want, David, do you want to go first?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to ask the committee's support for House Bill 2220. What we propose to do with this bill is to streamline the application process and reduce the regulatory burden that pawnbrokers have under the current ORS Chapter 726. We currently regulate and license pawnbrokers, and those are people who have to be licensed if they're going to make loans secured by pledged property. I'm sure most people know what pawnbroker is, at a rate of higher than 10% on an annual percentage basis. Licensees are required to post a surety bond or obtain some type of letter of credit to ensure that their activities don't violate the law and provide consumers with some form of financial protection if they need to take action for a violation. Pawnbrokers are limited in what they may charge statutorily. That is 3% per month or 36% per annum. In addition, they are limited in the fees they may collect. They are also required to provide other consumer protection features, including retaining the record of pledged property, and we think that's a very important piece in terms of consumer protection and enhancing law enforcement. I'll get into that in a little, in just a little bit. In addition, pawnbrokers are subject to regular regulatory examinations by our office. During the past 2 years, we've conducted examinations of the licensed pawnbrokers in Oregon, and we rarely have found any problems. They're all highly rated. We give them the highest rating of ones, and we have taken very few enforcement activities against pawnbrokers in the past several years. We believe that the industry is generally well run, and we think that the activities suggested in, or the changes suggested in 2220 are merited under the circumstances. Most notably, rather than require us to come through and do an exam every 2 years, the bill would allow us to do an examination on a for-cause basis. And that for-cause basis could be triggered by any number of reasons, whether we have a complaint from a consumer or whether we learn of a violation from any number of sources. Then we could go in and conduct the examination without having to burden them with a regular examination that confirms they're in good standing every 18 months to 2 years. In addition, and as I mentioned, they're required to keep records of all property that is pledged to secure the loans. Historically, the statute requires it to be done with ink. Well, in this day and age, that doesn't make sense to us. We think they should be able to retain their records electronically on a database. In fact, many local jurisdictions require they do just that to assist law enforcement. For instance, law enforcement will go in, they will take a laptop computer, download the items that have been received as pledged items in a given period of time, and compare that to a list of the items they have that have been identified as stolen. And that's how they track this information. And it's very simple and useful. Require them to do it in ink is either requiring them to keep duplicative records or keeping them from doing what law enforcement says is beneficial to them. So we would think that is a good decision to move forward into the 21st century. Finally, we want to streamline the licensing process a little bit. There's a requirement that they have to have their application posted for 30 days before we can approve their license. We do a significant amount of background checks, including criminal history and credit history. We don't see anything gained by having a 30-day posting on a wall in a government office building in Salem, when in this day and age, that information is available, again, electronically by our website. So we would urge the committee to consider doing away with that provision. Lastly, Mr. Romaine is going to talk about an amendment regarding a practice concerning lost pawn tickets. We've worked with Mr. Romaine and his association. We think this makes sense. We have no problems with the concept. And so the amendment that he's going to propose, we would also have no objection to. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, Mr. Tatum, I'm going to let you sit there. And Mr. Romaine, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, and I assume you'll incorporate the dash ones.
I will. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. We support everything that the department has said, and we would propose an amendment to House Bill 2220, which is House Bill 2220-1. What happened, the reason for the amendment, we just had a meeting with the department, and we were going over, as we usually do, practices of the agency. And there was one kind of crazy thing out there we thought we could solve by putting it into this particular bill. What it was a pawnbroker, somebody came into the pawn shop and had lost their ticket. And the pawnbroker knew the person, and they were completely satisfied that it was the right person, the owner of it, so they gave them back the ticket, or gave them back the item, the pawned item, without the actual pawn ticket. The statute currently requires a pawnbroker to keep that item for at least 3 days, not more than five, but at least 3 days before you give it back. It makes no sense to do that, because the pawnbroker is assuming the liability if they do give it back. We work with the department, and all the Dash 1 amendments does is allow us to, at our discretion, give it back, but we have up to 5 days. We don't have to wait 3 days if you come in and we know you and we know this is your item. That's the only thing the amendment does. Thank you.
Questions for either witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
And I apologize if the question has already been asked, but what's the history behind the residency requirement that this bill would eliminate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I'm not sure the reasoning behind that. I think there were times where the state of Oregon thought that there were advantages to putting limitations on people from outside the state having the ability to come in to the state and do business. In this day and age, many of the people that we license throughout the division don't necessarily reside in Oregon. The fact that if somebody lived in Vancouver and wanted to have a pawnbroker's store in Portland, I personally think that just is not good policy to say you can't do that. And so that's the reason why we're removing that. I don't think that it's designed to have a long-distance owner set up some type of facade, because there has to be a store, there has to be records on premise, everything has to be within the state of Oregon, so we're not doing away with the ability to make sure the consumer and the customers are protected. We're just saying that somebody doesn't necessarily have to be a citizen of Oregon to open up the store.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2220? Not seeing you jumping up to do so, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2220. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2202. Ms. Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2202 requires check cashing businesses to obtain a license from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, establishes licensing and regulatory program in DCBS, limits check cashing fees, declares an emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have DCBS here. Corey, I think you're going to stand in for the agency. And I'm going to go ahead and...
I'd like to be joined by Mr. Tapman, if I could.
You bet. Is there anyone else that you'd like?
This is one.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tapman, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2202, which is a high priority for the governor as part of his consumer protection agenda. And as Ms. Braun has said, House Bill 2202 would cap the fees that can be charged for cashing a check. And for someone without a bank account, often a check cashing service is the only way they have to cash a check. And disproportionately, those without bank accounts, both in Oregon and across the country, tend to be low income. The 2006 Oregon Population Survey included some questions about banking services and found that 11% of Oregon households do not have banking services, and that the numbers are higher for those in lower income brackets. 18% of households with incomes between $15,000 and $25,000 do not have bank accounts, and 22% of households with incomes under $15,000. Overall, 9% of Oregonians reported in that survey that they've paid a fee to cash a check. Again, the numbers are higher for those with the lower incomes. 14% of households between $35,000 and $25,000. 13% of those with incomes between $15,000 and $25,000. 10% of those with incomes below $15,000. And there are similar results nationally. For those households, check cashing services provide a very needed service, and we are not interested in closing down the check cashing industry, but we are interested in making sure that the fees are affordable. Since we don't currently regulate check cashing in Oregon at all, we don't have statistical data, but we informally do find check cashing businesses on some occasions charge as much as 6, 8, or even 10% of the check's face value for the customer to have access to their own funds. And if you think about someone with a paycheck, we care about them taking home a living wage from that paycheck. We set minimum wage requirements so that someone earning a paycheck can take their money home. If someone's receiving a government benefits check, we provide those government benefits so that that person can maintain an appropriate standard of living. And so making sure that those dollars end up in the pockets of the person for whom they're intended is actually important to us. 32 states and the District of Columbia currently regulate check cashing, and more than three-quarters of those states limit the fees that can be charged for cashing a check. Many states have tiered rates with differing fee amounts depending on with the type of check, whether it's a government check, a payroll check, or a personal or commercial check. And the allowable fees generally range from between 1 and 5% for government checks, and then up to 10% is the most common for personal checks. And attached to my testimony, you will find a state-by-state comparison showing you the laws in other states. And fee caps in other states have not hindered the industry's success. According to the Financial Services Centers of America, which is the trade association for this industry, the check cashing industry processes over 180 million checks annually, worth over $60 billion, which produces almost $1.5 billion in fee revenues. Roughly 80 to 90% of the checks cashed are payroll checks, according to this national trade publication, with an average check size of between $500 and $600. And the Trade Association also reports that less than 1% of the checks cashed are returned, and of that number, 80 to 90% ultimately are collected. As amended by the House, the bill would limit fees for check cashing to the greater of 2% or $5 for checks issued by the U.S. government or the state of Oregon or the city or county where the check cashing business is located, the assumption being that those are the lowest risk checks, 3% or $5 for payroll checks and all other government checks, 10% for all other checks, including personal checks. And for government and payroll checks, the bill would allow check cashers to charge an additional fee of 0.5% if the customer doesn't have valid current ID. And that was a suggestion from the check cashing industry that we think makes sense. The risk is higher, and the check cashing store has to take other steps to verify the identification. Through amendments on the House side, the total fee for cashing a check is capped at $100. And I will say we understand there's some discussion going on, and we've been privy to some of that discussion about whether that $100 cap should be more flexible in certain cases. So it's possible you will see some additional proposals in that regard. The bill would require check cashing businesses to be licensed and would give DCBS the authority to take action regarding violations, including restitution, and would give us rulemaking authority. And many of these check cashing businesses actually are already licensed by us for other types of business, money transmitting business, payday lending business, and so on. A retailer who cashes checks on an incidental basis, like a grocery store, for example, would not have to be licensed but would be limited to a fee of $2 or 2%, whichever is greater. And the bill would not apply to banks and credit unions who generally don't cash checks for non-account holders. House Bill 2202 would not require a business to cash every check. The check cashing business would be free to make a risk evaluation and decline to cash a check that they believed was suspicious or fraudulent or where they weren't satisfied with the identification of the customer. The bill does have a fiscal impact because it would require us to establish a new licensing program, and a corresponding policy package has been included in our budget, which has passed out of the full Ways and Means Committee with that policy package in it. So with the agreement of the Senate President's Office and the co-chairs and Legislative Fiscal Office, when you get to work session, we will be asking that you recommend rescission of that subsequent referral to Ways and Means that's on the bill today. Our understanding from the Senate President's Office and the co-chairs is that they would not require it to go to Ways and Means under those circumstances. We have attached a section-by-section analysis to the bill, and both Mr. Tapman and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have. We do ask for your support.
Thank you. Questions for either witnesses on the panel? Looks like you're off the hook. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for the presentation and also the section-by-section. All right, so now we're going to go ahead and get some public testimony. I've got Angela Martin, Sybil Hebb, and Art Towers. Why don't you three come up?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing Our Oregon and the Economic Fairness Coalition. The coalition includes many of Oregon's leading social service nonprofits, consumer advocates, faith-based organizations, and workers' unions. Every week, I speak with people who have firsthand experience with Oregon's high-cost financial market. Many of our coalition partners, like Fish Emergency Services and St. Vincent de Paul, conduct surveys in their facilities, people they serve, asking them what challenges they face in the high-cost financial market. I receive these surveys back in my office and will spend a night or two a week on the phone talking with folks, because this is how I learn a lot about what's going on in the lives of real people. So I'm going to take just a second to share two stories. One of them relates to bills we'll be hearing later, but I'm going to discuss it right now and then move on with my testimony. One woman I spoke with last week, her name is Patricia, and both of these folks indicated a willingness to speak with the lawmakers since they weren't able to be here. So if you're interested, know that I'll provide their phone numbers. Last week I spoke with Patricia, who still owes money on a $300 car title loan. She's paying $127 a month for 12 months, meaning she will pay back $1,524 for that $300 loan. Wow. Making the payments is a struggle. As she described, the loan has caused such a bad chain reaction, she's in a worse situation than she was before she took out the loan. DM Green, who goes by DM, is someone who told me about his experience in a check cashing store. Instead of seamlessly receiving his paycheck through electronic transfer, DM Green would take the check to a check cashing store that he passed every day on his way home, and every 2 weeks walk into that store and have 8% sliced off of his payroll check just to receive his own money. For a family with take-home pay of $25,000 a year, the fees alone add up to $2,000. Fortunately for DM and his family, he now has a bank account. And as he explained, it's really nice to have a place to cash and store his money. However, that's not the story for the 100,000 Oregonians or 1 in 8 low-income adults who continue to use a check-cashing store. These figures come from the most recent Oregon population survey. What we find when we ask them why they go to a check-cashing store instead of a bank, we get a range of responses. Those include honest mistakes. They have a financial blip or mistake on their background, and they're not eligible for a checking account. Others, geography and access to financial institutions is a barrier. According to the Oregon Center for Public Policy Analysis of the most recent Oregon population survey, 16% of all adults, and that's all adults, not just low income, 16% of all adults in the Tri-County Central Oregon area, Deschutes, Jefferson, Crook County, report paying check cashing fees. This is nearly double the average for the rest of our state. I include many other facts and statistics in my testimony that show how many adults use check cashing places. I'll allow you to read those at your will. What I do want to go on is to tell you about why these families rely on the fringe financial markets, the groups that are commonly known as payday lenders, auto title lenders, and check cashing outlets. That's where they turn to gain access to cash and credit. The providers of these services make it seem very easy, but we all know that they're selling this convenience at a steep premium price. And the service carries high costs and diminishes the ability for low-income families to accumulate assets and establish some financial stability. In the next month, hopefully all of us will be submitting our taxes. Hopefully many of us will be receiving a tax return. In Oregon, the last year I have figures for, 200,000 families received their return as an income tax credit. Last session, our lawmakers made a new state investment in this program, the country's largest anti-poverty program, and said we want to invest state dollars in this program that helps reward work and helps low-income families survive. What we do know is that a large chunk of those checks, which will be going out next week or next month and over the following month, will go to check cashers instead of the family budgets that they're intended for. At just 6%, cashing an earned income tax credit of check of $1,000 will cost a family $60. That's a considerable markup if you consider the estimate that the Federal Reserve Automated Clearinghouse puts out that cashing a government check costs about 4 cents. No risk for the store owner. It's definitely money in their pocket. But for the check cashier in a tight economy, it's money down the drain. That's what this bill can do. 2202 is an opportunity for us to give a lift to low and moderate income households who use these services, help put money back into the pockets of the hardworking Oregonians that deserve it so much. So I'm speaking now in favor of 2202. I'll hold my comments on the rest of the bills until those are called. Thank you.
That would be good since we only have a public hearing currently on 2202.
Oh, great.
Sybil.
Hello. Members of the committee, Chair Przanski. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm an attorney and legislative advocate with the Oregon Law Center, which is a statewide provider of free legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. Our mission at the Law Center is to provide access to civil justice for low-income Oregonians, and we've been very concerned with and interested in the discussion around regulation of the check-cashing industry, and very much appreciate this committee's attention and focus on this issue, as well as the other lending issues in front of the committee today, and very much appreciate the leadership of the governor and the DCBS and the Economic Fairness Coalition on all of this, so thank you. I want to echo the comments that have been made by those before me. I'll keep my testimony short and then would be happy to answer any questions, but our clients are exactly the people who will be impacted by this law if it passes, and our clients are low-income, Nevertheless, they are working, and many of them are the recipients of earned income tax credit benefits, and those benefits, as Angela described, are very low risk, very important to clients, and are an important message of public policy and support for low-income families. And to charge high rates, high fees to cash those checks when they are so low risk would be completely contrary to the public purpose for which they were established in the first place. By the same token, our concern is about payroll checks. Again, they're relatively low risk, and they are very important to the people who are working so hard to bring home such minimal earnings. But we want to make sure that the industry is not charging such high fees that that these people are deprived of the dollars that they're working so hard to bring home to their families. I would only add that I very much appreciate, again, the comprehensive look at these issues and the interrelated nature of these matters, and thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Art?
Hello. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, a political director for Service Employees Union Local 503, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I really, our union is really thrilled with the leadership shown by the governor, by DCBS, and by members of the Oregon legislature for taking these issues up. A lot of folks wonder, like, why is our union working so hard on this issue? Our members, by and large, make a living wage, and is this a traditional labor issue? And the leadership of our union over the course of the last couple of years, including at our convention last year, decided that issues of economic fairness outside the workplace are important issues as well. It should be a priority for our union. Why? For our own members, we're a union of low-wage workers. We represent two-thirds of our members are women. Many of them are living in poverty despite our best efforts. We have more than 4,000 state workers who earn less than the eligibility level for food stamps for a family of four. These are groundskeepers. These are clerical workers. These are maintenance workers and food service workers throughout the state. And our workers, our members, are often targeted by these industries. Why? They are working, so they do have a payday. They have a payday that's once a month, and they don't make much money. And so House Bill 2202 and the other bills we'll be considering today are of prime importance for our members and for their neighbors and for our communities. We support House Bill 2202, and we will... You can look forward to similar testimony here in the other public hearings. Thank you very much.
All right. Questions for anyone on the witnesses? Senator Beyer, please.
Thank you. Ms. Martin, I'm curious, you talked about a geographical barrier that some people have to financial institutions, yet you listed Deschutes, Jefferson, Crook County as being the areas where there's a higher, almost twice the average rate of people using check cashing versus other financial institutions. Yet my knowledge of Central Oregon would say that Deschutes, Jefferson, Crook County are three of the most populated counties in Eastern or Central Oregon, and they probably have more financial institutions, banks and credit unions than anywhere else in Eastern Oregon, and probably as many or more there are in Western Oregon. So why would it be a geographic barrier in those three counties in particular?
I could have chosen a more appropriate word, and that would be transportation. As we go out into the communities and talk with folks about the barriers, the geography, the widespread out area where I live in Mille Pine and I work perhaps in another community, transportation continually comes up for folks as one of the barriers they face to making the best financial decisions for themselves. So I could have used a better word there. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I guess a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
Could you tell me if there are communities, let's take those three counties, are there communities in those counties that have check cashing stores that don't have other financial institutions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'd be happy to look at the locations of those financial institutions. One of the challenges I would face in mapping these, and we've done some similar mapping for payday loan stores and car title loan stores, is that without a state registration, it's thumbing through a phone book and trying to determine what type of service each business offers. So I'd be happy to provide what we do know about those, but it's going to be limited based on the fact that they're not registered right now.
But, Mr. Chair, that's not necessary. I mean, I guess my point would be that I know that, you know, the major community, Deschutes County, would be Sisters and Bend and Redmond, and those all have banks and credit unions. Jefferson County would be Madras, would be the major community there, and that clearly has banks and credit unions. And Crook County, the major town in Crook County, is Prineville, and I know it has banks and credit unions. So, and I think if you get into Lapine, also has banks and credit unions. So I don't, I'm curious to know why it would be, you know, a double in those three counties.
If you have an answer, if you don't, you don't. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. I've got two other individuals that are signed up on the sheet for 2202. Tom, I'm sorry, I can't. Your last name, S-H-A-U. I don't know if it's a B or an L. Okay. Well, come on up. You still get to speak. And then Diane McCartney. Come on up, if you wouldn't mind. And Tom, I'm going to go ahead and let you go first since I called you first, and if you'll just put your name on the record for us, and I hopefully won't butcher it next time I say it.
My name is Tom Shockless. I want to take the opportunity to acknowledge my appreciation for...
Tom, I think since you have a unique last name, for the record, okay. I'm going to ask you to go ahead and spell it so we can make sure it's captured.
It's Lithuanian. It's S S and Sam H A U K L A S.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Chairman Senator Posansky and members of the Senate Commerce Committee, my name is Thomas Shockless. I am the president of the Community Financial Services Association of Oregon and Vice President of Oak Brook Financial Corporation, which operates 45 storefront locations in Oregon, offering check cashing, short-term loans, and other other financial services. I appreciate the opportunity, as I say, to testify before the committee on House Bill 2202. Fee-based storefront check cashing centers began operating in Oregon in the early 1980s in response to the trend of banks to abandon free services that were previously provided to the public to use their resources to expand fee-generating financial products. These centers compete not only among themselves, but also with many lower-cost options available to consumers, including maintaining checking accounts and cashing checks at banks, grocery stores, Walmart, and other retail outlets. We estimate that fewer than 2% of adult Oregonians regularly use check cashing services. Nobody has to go there. They go there out of convenience. They make a consumer choice. Consumers choose check cashers as a convenience and because of the additional services offered. And I might add, many of the check cashing stores are open 7 days a week with extended hours, perhaps from 8 till 9 or 7 till 9 at night. For example, most check cashing services provide free money orders to their customers who cash checks. Sometimes this savings will offset the entire fee. Check cashing services have developed methods that result in a faster and more pleasant consumer experience. They cash checks that banks and others will either not cash at all or will only allow to be deposited with a hold up to 2 weeks before releasing funds. Check cashers distributed food stamps for the state of Oregon for many years until the advent of the Oregon Trail Card, which recipients now use to access both food stamps and cash benefits electronically. And I might add they were very satisfied with the service provided by check cashing stores because, again, of the convenient neighborhood locations as well as the expanded hours that allowed them to come in on Saturdays and Sundays as opposed to just Monday through Friday. Check cashing services have operated for nearly 25 years in Oregon with virtually no consumer complaint. Their fees are already regulated by the competitive marketplace. HB 2202 would mandate a menu of service fees with fee caps on different types of checks as low as 2% of face value and would establish a maximum fee of $100 for any check. HB 2202 is a part of a family of bills whose stated purpose is to regulate predatory lenders. Check cashing transactions are neither predatory nor loans. Among the 22 states west of the Mississippi River, only three, Arizona, California, and Hawaii, have fee caps at all. None of those three states have fee caps under 3%, and even then only for government assistance checks. No state has a maximum limit on the amount of a fee to be charged on a given check. Presently, check cashers in Oregon rarely charge a fee of greater than 3% for government and payroll checks. The competitive market dictates that pricing. We oppose a mandated fee limitation. We particularly oppose placing a maximum fee of $100 per check. We are sometimes presented with very large checks to cash, such as insurance settlements, legal or estate settlements, large back payments of workman's compensation, commercial checks, and others. These are checks that no bank or grocery store could or would cash. At best, a bank would allow deposit to a customer's account, but withhold funds up to 2 weeks. These large checks present huge dollar risk if they end up being counterfeit, forged, NSF, or stop payment. Since these checks cannot be collected in a small claims venue, they can require thousands of dollars of legal and collection expense and tie up huge amounts of cash while being collected. Consumers can choose whether to use check cashing centers to cash large checks. Fees for making efforts and taking those risks should not be limited by statute. We will be offering language that will amend this bill to place a $100 cap on any check cashing fee originating from a state agency, or that is a payroll check, and ask this committee to support this amendment to the bill. And we're trying to work right now with DCBS on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. McCartney?
My name is Diane McCartney, and I'm Vice President of Compliance for Ace Cash Express, Inc. And thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to speak to HB 2202. Ace Cash Express is the largest check cashing company in the country. We have over 1,700 stores in 38 states plus the District of Columbia, and hold 19 check cashing licenses in 19 states where we operate who require check cashing licenses. I gave information about the company and about our activity here in Oregon. We do have 12 corporately owned stores and 3 franchise owned stores here in the state of Oregon. On the check cashing front, in the last 12 months here in Oregon, we cashed over 159,000 checks worth $64 million with an average check size of $403, and that's in the information that I left for you there. Our comments and concerns about HB 2202. First of all, we do support licensing and regulation of check cashing. We support that for some of the testimony you heard earlier, because we do not want folks out there cashing charging exorbitant fees that basically taint the reputation of the industry. So we support in general the concept of licensing and regulation of check cashing. Also, in looking at the fee caps in HB 2202, as Director Streisinger said, we see them in line with what we see nationally in our other states that regulate check cashing fees. So we do not object to the percentages that are in the bill. We do have a couple of areas of concern. The first one is on the $100 fee cap on all checks. We at first objected to that fee cap because we hadn't seen it in any of the 19 states where we are licensed to cash checks. However, in visiting with Director Streisinger and her staff, it appeared that the concern is really about government and payroll checks. And so we support the fee cap for those check types, but ask that the bill be amended so that the other check types do not fall under that $100 cap. We ask that because we cash checks that similar, like an insurance draft check, that might be a larger amount, and those carry higher risk. And so we would like the ability to serve the customers here in Oregon by being able to negotiate a fee to cash that check for them that's in line with the risk. So again, we support the $100 fee cap on the government checks and payroll checks, but request that the other check types not be included under that $100 fee cap. The next area we would like to suggest is a new customer fee be added to the fees permitted to be charged. Currently, the way it's drafted, it's unclear whether or not a new customer fee is permitted. We find that with new customers, again, higher risk situation with a new customer than with returning customers, and also the fact that there's data entry and additions to the system required for new customers, but primarily the higher risk. So would a request your consideration for an amendment to add a new customer fee in the states that do specifically have that in their legislation. The range is from $5 to $10. We're requesting $5. The last area is what appears to be an inconsistency in the bill with the $5 minimum that is incorporated into the sections about the government checks being cashed and the payroll checks being cashed. It's that percentage, say 2% or $5, whichever is greater. But that $5 minimum is not in the other check fee category. And we find that in the states that regulate or cap all check types, which is what Oregon is proposing to do, that they do have a minimum dollar amount for all check types. Again, it just simply permits us to serve our customers who want to come in and cash smaller checks, allows us to charge what we need to cover the processing costs for those checks. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to testify before the committee. Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Chair has a couple of questions. I guess I'd like to have a little more explanation. First of all, on the cap of $100 for the state agency checks, based on the testimony the chair heard from DCBS, seems to me the risk there is extremely low. And so I'm trying to figure out at what level of check are we talking about would have a cap that would be a state agency check of $100? And what level of check are we talking about that you would be wanting $100 for a state agency issued check?
Well, it's the greater.
Right, no.
No, it's the greater.
I probably wasn't clear because what I was trying to say was the $100 ceiling that's currently in the bill, we're asking that that ceiling apply to government checks and payroll checks, but that it not apply to other check types like insurance drafts.
I understand.
Okay, sorry.
What I'm trying to figure out is if we have a check that's coming from a state agency, which what I heard was the risk was extremely low, what's the justification for $100 as a fee? And so I'm assuming it's based on a dollar amount of the check. And I'm not I'm just trying to get in my mind. I have not looked at what the percentages would be or the amount that could be charged. I'm trying to figure out what size of checks are we talking about that would be state issued for that you'd want $100 to cover the risk.
Well, if I might answer, all it takes is just a check that has a size larger such that 3% of that particular check is greater than 100, it would be up to $100. Are those checks frequently we cash? No, but the risk, and this is really kind of a misconception. Chair Prozanski, it's a misconception. Checks do get returned. Even checks that come from the state of Oregon or federal checks, there are many occasions where an individual go in and say, many occasions, there are occasions where an individual go in and for example, receive some sort of welfare benefit check, say from the state of Oregon, go in, cash that check, immediately walk out of the store and get a hold of their caseworker or walk over to the caseworker's office and say, I didn't get that check, it was stolen. Somebody got it. And then that check is returned to us, and it's a very complicated long-term process to get paid back. The onus is on us to demonstrate, as well as it should be, to demonstrate that the person who came in and cashed the check was not indeed the intended recipient. On federal checks, like U.S. Treasury checks, if somebody comes in, receives their Social Security, and comes in and cashes it in a check cashing store, they can then contact the Social Security office and say, hey, I never got that check, even though we have their ID, we have their signature, we have a card they filled out, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt it is who we cashed the check for the intended payee. Then we have to, the check is automatically returned to our account. Most banks will not allow us to deal with the returned item at the bank level. We have to deal with an agency in Hyattsville, Maryland, that's across the United States, that could take upwards to 12 months, if you're fortunate enough, to convince them with the preponderance of evidence that we typically would have. Copy of the ID, copy of the check, copy of the card filled out by the consumer, and a copy of their signature. And so there is a legitimate concern because of the process of trying to collect those funds. And indeed, you can't take any action against a government agency. So literally, you're confronted with a situation of convincing them that you did it for the right person. And if they say no, you didn't, there's not really a legal avenue to collect that money. You're literally out the money, as it were.
Okay. I have one other question first, if I could. And that's regarding the new customer fee. And Diane and Tom, for both of you, since you have stores, and Diane, what I got from your testimony, you have two or three that are franchise stores in the state. The rest are company stores.
Correct.
If I came into the store in Eugene and opened up a new customer or was a new customer there and paid that fee, would I, if I went to one in Springfield, if you had one in Springfield, would I have to have a new fee for that particular store, or would I be in your database that anywhere I went in the system I would be considered a regular customer?
For the Ace Corporately Owned stores, it's across the board. So once a customer is in our system as a new customer, because we use that same risk factor for that same customer, they're in the system. So it's one time. It's a one-time new customer fee.
So what I'm hearing is that within the stores that are ran by the company, everyone is interconnected by the database that you use, and then your franchisees would be
as separate legal entities. Yeah, they would be.
And Tom,
it would be similar with us. If they went into one of our stores and we identified them as the customer, that would be the one-time charge for the new customer fee. And it's a legitimate concern because one of the challenges we have is when a customer comes in the very first time, there is a much more involved process that we go through because we want to assure ourselves that they are who they say. Based upon one is if they don't have the traditional ID that customers may have, and even if they do, to make sure that we don't have a junior as opposed to a senior or vice versa. So there's much more time spent on that very first transaction.
Okay, one other follow-up I meant to ask you, Tom. Oak Brook Financial Corp, DBA is what?
DBA is Cash Connection, Check Cash Northwest, Urgent Money, Fast Check. And that wasn't not by design. That was by basically cobbling together stores that people were selling and did not want to lose the value of the goodwill that they had built up.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. On government checks, is there a lower number of them or percentage of them that are forged or fake versus other standard checks? And I'm thinking particularly of State of Oregon checks. I mean, it seems like U.S. Treasury checks, they kind of look like a computer punch card. They're probably really hard to duplicate on a color copier. But State of Oregon checks just look like, they look like they come off of any old piece of paper. So are they a lower incidence of those being fake, versus standard two-party checks or payroll checks?
I think for us, the ones that we see, the government checks that we see the most fraudulent activity in are the tax refund checks. It was as Tom was describing the process that happens where someone can simply claim that they lost it and have a replacement one issued. And then if that one gets cashed, then the first one is basically charged back to us. So it's the tax refund checks primarily.
That's a good observation, Senator. We used to, when there were more checks, before the Oregon Trail Card came out, when there were more state-issued benefit checks, we saw a lot more of it. It has diminished somewhat because there aren't as many of those checks out there right now. You don't see as much counterfeiting as you do payees who go in and will attempt to induce the teller to cash the check and not pay attention and scribble their signature, and then they can go out and then make a claim that they didn't cash the check, and they'll say, well, gosh, look, the signatures don't match up.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much for
thank
both of you being here.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 2202? Not seeing anyone rushing up here, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 2202. And we're now going to open up public hearings on three bills that are remaining. Those three bills are going to be House Bill 2203, House Bill 2204, and House Bill 2205. And I'm going to ask DCBS, why don't you all come up first, and we'll get the framework for the three bills up on the record, and then we'll start in with the testimony from the public. And before you get started, before I get in trouble, Ms. Ron, did you want to give us a summary, long, short, or whatever?
Very short summary. All these bills have to do with lending and regulation by DCBS. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, accompanied by David Tatman, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these three bills, which, as Ms. Braun said, all do deal with different aspects of lending activity, and all of which, as with the previous bill, are part of the governor's consumer protection agenda. These three bills all in different respects follow up on the payday lending bill that came out of the special session in 2006. And by way of background, our department licenses three different types of consumer finance lenders, depending on the type of lending business. The three types of lending businesses are payday lending, vehicle title lending, and what we call conventional consumer finance lending. And the bills in front of you today deal with all three of those loan types and the relationships among them. And I want to start with payday lending. A payday loan, as you may recall from the special session discussions, is a short-term loan for a period of 60 days or less, typically made to someone who has a regular paycheck or another regular source of income. It's secured by a post-dated check or authorization to draw out of a bank account, and it's generally scheduled to be repaid at the time of the person's next payday. If the borrower cannot pay, the loan can be rolled over or renewed for another term upon payment of another fee. Currently, the special session law not having gone into effect yet, currently charges for these loans are in the range of $15 to $20 per $100 borrowed, and a typical loan term is 17 to 18 days. And if you take those charges expressed as an annual percentage rate, the fees can often exceed 400 to 500%. So the special session bill, which goes into effect on July 1st of this year, caps the fees and interest that can be charged for these loans, required the loan term to be at least 31 days, limited the rollovers to two, and provided that a new payday loan could not be made within 7 days of when another loan expired. So House Bill 2203, the first of the bills in front of you, deals primarily with payday loans, and it follows up on the special session bill in several different ways. First, the bill directs DCBS to implement a database that will enable us as well as lenders to track compliance with the restrictions on payday loans. Similar databases are currently required in five other states. Lenders in those states and under this bill would be required to enter information into the database for each of their loans, and so we would be able to confirm compliance with the limits on rollovers as well as compliance with that seven-day, that waiting period. And in addition, each lender issuing a new loan would be able to check the database to make sure that the loan that they were about to issue is, in fact, a legal loan. Without that type of a database, it's almost impossible for a lender to know whether or not that waiting period is in effect. Lenders would pay a per-transaction fee to use the database, which could be passed on to the borrower under this bill. The fee amount would be set by rule, and based on the experience of other states, we anticipate the cost would be less than a dollar per loan transactions. There have been some concerns raised that this type of database would place borrowers' personal data at risk of identity theft, and as I think you all know, that's a great concern to us, and we've been working with this committee on an ID theft bill. It's a concern with the thousands upon thousands of databases that exist in this state and across the country, maintained by private businesses, maintained by government entities. And with respect to the database proposed by this bill, of course, the same standards would apply that we're looking at in Senate Bill 583 in terms of safeguarding that data. We would, in addition, expect to follow the lead of the other states that have gone this route and use a private vendor who has experience in this area. There have not been any problems with security breaches in the states that use this type of vendor. And in addition, the database would be structured so that a lender would not have access to a borrower's personal data in using the database. database. They would enter data that the borrower supplies to them and would get a yes or no answer back in terms of compliance, but they would not actually be able to find data in the database about people's personal finances or identifying information. One other concern that's been raised, it was raised on the House side, and it's been raised with us by some of the stakeholders, is some people have predicted that there will not be a payday lending industry after this bill, after the special session bill goes into effect, and should we have a database requirement if we have no industry? And obviously, we have no prediction about the status of the industry when the special session law goes into effect, but we don't want to have a database that has no purpose. So it may be useful to think about whether at some extremely low loan volumes the database should not be required, and we're happy to look at that issue, and as I say, some of the stakeholders have raised that with us, so it's possible that we would make a suggestion in terms of additional flexibility in that regard. The database would also apply to vehicle title loans, which I'll get to in a minute. The second issue addressed in House Bill 2203 is payday lending by out-of-state lenders, many of whom do business over the Internet. And the bill would make our payday lending laws applicable to interstate and other out-of-state lenders who make payday loans to Oregon residents who are physically present in Oregon. And the goal is to establish a level playing field, so with equal protections for all Oregonians taking out these types of loans, regardless of whether the lender has a brick-and-mortar presence here in Oregon. All lenders making payday loans in Oregon would be required to be licensed and comply with the restrictions and to enforce compliance, because, of course, compliance is always a challenge when we're dealing with those who are not present in Oregon. The law would provide that a lender would not be able to collect on its debt if it was out of compliance with Oregon law, and that is similar to the provisions in place in Oregon law today for unlicensed pawnbrokers and for unlicensed construction contractors. So we use those models in putting this bill together. This bill would also clarify one issue in the special session law to ensure that when a borrower defaults on a payday loan, the lender will be able to recover collection costs on the same basis that any other lender would be able to recover collection costs. There was some ambiguity in the special session bill in that regard, and the -A2 amendments address that issue. We had language in the original bill on the House side addressing it, but there was some concern about whether it was accurate, so we are planning to ask you for some an additional amendment to clarify that issue. House Bill 2204 deals with vehicle title loans, and these are short-term loans secured by the title to a motor vehicle, could be a recreational vehicle or a boat or a mobile home as well as a car, and they are also for a period of 60 days or less repaid with a single payment, and currently there are no limits on the interest rates or fees that lenders can charge for these loans, and we are finding rates similar to those charged by payday lenders, often upwards of 300%. So, and current law allows these loans to be renewed up to 6 times after the first loan. We are proposing in this bill restrictions on vehicle title loans to match those that were put on payday loans during the special session. So limiting the annual percentage rate to 36% or 3% a month, plus an origination fee of up to 10%, limiting renewals to 2, and providing that the loans have to have a term of 31 days, at least 31 days, as well as the 7-day, not allowing a new loan within 7 days of an existing loan. Fees on dishonored checks would be capped as well as with payday loans. So essentially matching the special session law for payday loans. The third bill is House Bill 2205, and this deals with the conventional consumer finance loans. And conventional consumer finance lenders who have been in place in Oregon for many years, this is the household finance, city finance, United Finance type of loans, they traditionally make installment loans for longer periods of time than payday or title loans based on the creditworthiness of the borrower. And interest rates on these loans historically have not approached the rates that we've seen in the payday and title lending markets. But following the special session law, we saw many of the payday lenders start applying for conventional loan licenses. And we became concerned that since the payday loan limits apply only to loans of 60 days or less, that we would see payday loan type business spring up under this conventional license type for terms of 61 days or more. In other words, using the conventional license to evade the restrictions that the legislature had passed. So as an effort to prevent this, we issued rules that went into effect in late December, more clearly defining the type of lending that could take place under a conventional lending license. And our new rules provide that most loans under this license type have to be for a term of 6 months or more. They have to be fully amortizing, installment-type loans with substantially equal periodic payments. They have to be based on creditworthiness, and the lender has to employ experienced staff appropriate to this type of lending activity. And we do believe that these rules are fully authorized under existing law, but during the rulemaking, we did have several payday lenders come forward and challenge our rulemaking authority and say that we did not have the authority to issue those rules. So in order to avoid any possibility of a legal challenge, in House Bill 2205, we are asking you to codify those rules to clearly define in statute the type of lending business that can take place under a conventional lending license. The bill was amended on the House side to conform to the rules. The bill was initially drafted before the rules were in their final form, but there were, again, some drafting challenges and some concerns were raised with the House-passed version of the bill, specifically with respect to the definitional portions of the bill, as well as the scope of rulemaking authority. So we have continued to work with stakeholders on those issues, and we are proposing the Dash A2 amendments that we believe will address the concerns that have been raised with the language. And these issues were discussed during work session on the House side, and the House committee felt comfortable leaving those issues to your committee to address. So I do ask for your support for these three bills as well, and Mr. Tatman and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Question, Senator Beyer first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Senate Bill, House Bill 2205, to me, you can't have both ways. Either rules you passed are legal or they're not. And if they're legal, you don't need the bill. And if they're not, you broke the law. So, which one is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe that the rules are legal and we have not broken the law, and that in order to avoid a legal challenge, it would be advisable we would request that this committee confirm those rules in law. But if you ask me whether I believe our rules are valid, the answer is absolutely yes, I do. We've received legal advice to that effect.
Well, I guess then I would say we don't need the bill.
All right. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We have a couple of different panels. I'm going to ask everyone to be respectful of the time that you take, and if you can summarize testimony, especially if you're handing it in instead of reading it word for word, please give us summaries, or the chair may use its prerogative to ask you as you're giving your word-by-word testimony. Laura Etherton, Angela Martin, Sybil Hibb. If you don't want y'all three first start off. And Mr. Harvey, I got a note that said that you wanted to maybe give testimony on 2203. Opening remarks. Okay, well, we'll get you there. I'm assuming that you're here in opposition or neutral?
Let's say neutral.
Okay. Based on our conversations in the office, I wasn't sure I should be putting you down as for the bill, so I figured it had to be one of the other two. All right. All right, whoever wants to get started.
Good afternoon again. For the record, my name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing Our Oregon and the Economic Fairness Coalition. And I will attempt to be brief because the sunshine outside is so very enticing.
Yes, it is.
I'd like to speak in favor of 2203, 2204, and 2205. And take the opportunity to not only thank you for hearing these bills, but express our gratitude toward the governor and DCBS for taking leadership on this on these bills. I'm going to start by simply saying that we agree 2203 is a good piece of legislation. I agree with the comments that were made earlier that we should have the opportunity to look at the database, and if the loan volume is low enough that it doesn't make sense to implement it, we would agree with that. 22-4, as you heard, takes the provisions of the law that was passed during special session, the Penny Loan Reform Act, and applies it to car title loans. A couple of points I want to make to this. 22-04, if we're looking at the figures from 2004, and I always have a lag time on the figures that I have available to me, but if we look at 2004 figures, House Bill 2204 would make amendments and change the rules for about one-third of the car title loans that were issued that year. The remaining two-thirds of car title loans that were issued in 2004 were issued under a different license. The average interest rate for those loans, which were a little over 44,000 loans, average interest rate was 372%. That is the type of loan, that is the license that the woman I mentioned in my first round of testimony, Patricia, she took out a long-term car title loan in well in excess of 300% interest. She's the woman who I explained took out a $300 loan and was making payments, 12 monthly payments of $127 per month. I think it's important to recognize that 2204 is a good bill, but it does not curb all high-cost lending and all high-cost car title lending. I want to make some additional comments on 2205 and take an opportunity to explain some of the concerns that we have about this bill, which I said we support, but recognize there are some concerns that need to be raised. It's been well documented across the nation that high-cost predatory lenders have a track record for evading state laws that are put in place to restrain the costs of these loans. In an effort to end predatory high-cost lending, lawmakers in states like Illinois, lawmakers in states like Pennsylvania have put strong legislation in place, which has been quickly skirted. I'm going to take two examples to carry out here. In Virginia, car title lending, which was banned in that state, car title lenders are legally evading the 36% small loan, 36% interest small loan law by making loans under their open-end credit loophole. It was difficult for the state of Virginia. They didn't apply the 36% cap to open-end credit card type loans, and that's the route that car title lenders there were using to evade the state law. That similar type of loophole exists with 2205 in that some of the strong protections offered under 2205 aren't applied to open-end credit. I also want to look at Pennsylvania, where Advance America, the country's leading payday lender, has recently launched a new product called Choice Line of Credit and has a low introductory interest rate of 5.9%, which sounds obviously very good. But the borrower must also pay monthly fees of $149 a month for a $500 line of credit. Therefore, a person who borrows $500 and makes the minimum payments will pay $4,000 over the course of 2 years for that original $500 line of credit. House Bill 2205 makes improvements to the longer-term installment-type loans, but those changes do not block lenders from developing other high-cost loan products. The only effective policy for ending 500% loans is a uniform cap on interest rates, which is why we offer our strongest support for House Bill 2871, which is not before you today, but trust will be before you in the near future. I'll end by talking about what's happening at the national level, because I do think it's illustrative of what's happening across the country. Last October, Congress passed a uniform 36% cap on loans made to active military members and their family. What that means for...
Martin, I want to not let you testify on that. That bill's not before us at this point. And since we've already got other bills that have other provisions, once we get the bill here, or if we have an amendment that's going to be there, then I'll let you testify on that.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
You bet. Ms. Etherton?
Thank you, Chair Prusansky and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bills 2203, 2204, and 2205. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest organization. I think just to summarize briefly, we were very proud of Oregon. I think in 2006, during the special session when the legislature passed payday loan consumer protections, including provisions to give consumers a full 31 days to repay the loan, to limit the number of rollovers to two, and perhaps most importantly, introduce that 36% cap or $10 per $100 loaned as a cap on the interest rates that consumers were being paid in response to triple digits, sometimes loans that we saw reaching four digits in the numbers of in the rates of interest. These bills before you today are critical to extending those very smart provisions to the title loans and to payday loans that are made to Oregonians but by industries that are out of state through the internet or through the phone or the mail, and those are critically important. I think in addition, we are very supportive of the introduction of the internet the tracking database to make sure that the provisions of the bill are clearly enforceable and that it helps lenders comply with the law and not be bouncing consumers back and forth between lenders during that period where they should not be taking out another loan. And finally, on 2205, this is we also support this, which adds clarification to the conventional consumer license, with the aim of preventing inappropriate lending happening under that license in an attempt to evade some of these other laws. That bill does fall short of actually extending the same protections, including the 36% cap to those loans, which we believe will ultimately be necessary to actually protect consumers from loans that exceed those rates, but absolutely a positive step forward. And finally, just to wrap up, wanted to thank the governor and folks at DCBS for bringing these issues forward and for their work to protect consumers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and I'll speak to all three of the bills and indicate my great thanks to the committee and those who have worked so hard to bring these forward. We very much appreciate the help that they will offer to low-income individuals who are our clients. It's our mission to help those individuals have free and full lives and have access to justice and not be caught up in this sort of never-ending spiral of debt, which we think can happen when consumers without bargaining power enter agreements that have unregulated and inappropriate fees and interest rates attached to them. We appreciate the level of regulation and oversight that's offered by the bills and think that they strike a good balance, allow the industry to remain healthy in Oregon but not predatory, and so we appreciate that, and would only also add that I think these provide a great foundation and an important first step towards assuring basic economic fairness across the state. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone? Senator Monroe.
Yeah, have any of you investigated as to the percentage of these short-term loans that are used for gambling purposes? There's been some articles that I've read lately that seem to indicate that payday loans and title loans are often used by people that maybe have a bit of an addiction to gambling, and they think they're going to make their money back real quick and then usually don't.
I've read the same stories that you have, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Monroe. And that is definitely an area for concern in terms of what people are having to use these loans for, whether it's gambling. But what I think we've found overall is people use these loans for any number of things, whether it's to pay for a gambling habit, but more often it's to pay for groceries or pay the rent or to pay for medicine. So it's people are in a tough place. They're looking for quick cash and often get themselves in a worse position than they ever would have been before taking out the loan. And these protections before you today and the ones that the legislature passed in April of 2006 all will help to rein in that practice and protect Oregonians regardless of the ultimate purpose of the loan.
Thank you. All right. Ladies, thank you very much. Our next panel is going to consist of Art Towers, Martha Pellegrino, and then is it Bina Patel?
Bina,
excuse me. Mr. Towers, I want to let you go first,
okay,
and followed by Martha and then Bina.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And I simply want to put our union on record in support of this legislation. Again, as I testified before on the other bills, we're thrilled with the direction the governor and the agency and the legislature is moving on this topic. And we simply want to be on record in support of this legislation. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino with the City of Portland. I'm here today. Commissioner Dan Saltzman has submitted a letter supporting House Bill 2203, 2204, and 2205 based on the city's passage of a payday loan ordinance in February 2006 because it was very clear that in the city it was several of our citizens were being taken advantage of. We appreciate the work that was done during the special session, but also see that these three bills will close necessary loopholes to give the full effect to the legislation. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bina Patel. I'm director of the Oregon Asset Policy Initiative with the Cascade Policy Institute, but I'm here today to also represent a different perspective. I've provided hundreds of hours of financial education one-on-one with working families in the Portland area over the last several years. Most of them were all low income, as I mentioned, and it was in the context of working in a nonprofit based out of Portland that provided a host of services to low-income working families. And what I wanted to say is I've approached this problem from many angles. I've seen families pre and post taking out payday loans and auto title loans and have counseled them one-on-one on their budgeting, on their behavior, and their financial choices. And briefly, what I want to get to, since you have my testimony before you, is that capping these kinds of financial services, in fact, reduces the supply of them. We know that some of these businesses are going to go under and they will not be operating anymore, regardless of where they're located. On the front end, we think that's great because we would have less access, let's say. We would have less families taking out those loans. What I've learned, though, 100%, is that this is a question of behavior and access to maintain stability for a family. Many of these families, as we just heard, are making the decision between rent, groceries, and other kinds of basic needs bills. For many of these, taking out a payday loan or an auto title loan, in fact, is the cheaper of many of the other alternatives. You can see on the back of my testimony, there's a graph that's been pulled from the City of Portland just a couple of days ago. I've had clients that have said, I can't pay my water bill. What do I do? I can't pay my rent. What do I do? I can't go to a bank because my checks, for example, are bouncing. I don't have a bank account, et cetera. I don't have any family to turn to, and I'm not able to get emergency services. If their water is turned off, if they're evicted, if they're not able to access short-term small loan credit, in fact, these problems snowball. You can see that some of these bills amount into the hundreds of dollars when their water is turned off. And not only are they without the credit, for example, they are now also without the service. This is true across the board. I've had families where we figured out the numbers and it's cheaper to take a payday loan, include counseling on how to pay that back responsibly, than to rack up continued credit card bills, given the interest rate and the late fees that go along with credit card bills. So conclusively, what I have learned is that while it's difficult to work through the hardships that families face, particularly when they're low income, what is extremely difficult and almost impossible is to work with families when there is no access to any credit at all. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel? Bina, I do one question, maybe a couple questions. Your testimony is on 2204 and 2205.
Mm-hmm.
Have you actually taken a position as to for or against?
We're neutral on the bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you walk through the example, please, on the reverse of your
sure.
testimony? I really appreciate that you've brought forward the subject of financial education,
mm-hmm.
Something that we need to make sure we is introduced into our public school
mm-hmm.
education. It starts there, I think. But if you would walk through the example on the back and just tell us what it is you want us to be aware of.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, this was pulled from the City of Portland Water Bureau billing. You can go right online and pull this and see that if you were late on a bill, this is the process and the scheduling they would follow should you be late on one of their bills. So on day zero is when they're going to bill you, so you'll receive that after, let's say, 4 to 5 days at the maximum, generally about a day if you're in Portland and it's coming right from there. You have 21 days to pay this bill from the time they've billed you. At day 28, if they haven't received any payment from you, 1% of what you should be paying them is going to be added on to your balance, and is going to be the carrying charge. Basically, that 7 days that you're past due now, they're charging you to hold that account open for you. After that, when they send you the reminder notice that, by the way, you haven't paid us yet, just a slip of paper, and I've seen it come, they're going to tack on another $5 for sending you that piece of paper at day 35. At day 42, when they haven't heard anything from you, or you have already called and tried to set up a payment plan but have failed to make those payments, if they haven't received any cash from you on that, and you get this pre-shut-off notice, which means we are not going to shut it off yet, but you have 5 days to get us your payment. So again, another piece of paper. You're going to get a $10 charge. So we're at 1% of whatever your balance was, plus another $15 already to be told that, by the way, you're late and you're going to get your water shut off. At day 49, you can see the service would be disconnected. And to have your service disconnected, the consumer is paying $40 on top of that $15 already. And so this is how it continues to snowball. If you're using the water, and because they haven't shut off the water yet and they find out that you've been using water past that day 49, they're going to come and lock your meter, read your meter, get the final reading, and you are charged another $50 on top of all of those fees and your initial payment. Another 14 days later, they're going to say, we told you not to use your meter. You locked it. The water company locked it, but you were able to turn your faucet on. And if they see that your meter has moved at all, you're dinged another $75 on top of that. At the very final end, when they say no more, you can't use any water, they'll come and turn your water lines off. And that could be $300 upwards. So these all accrue one on top of the other.
Yeah, I appreciate the example. I've had constituents in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
The illustration is very helpful.
Thank you.
I do want one clarification, though. On that approximately 14 days later, removal of the meter, if unauthorized usage continues, that tells me that someone's not just turning on their faucet. They're going out to where the meter has actually been shut down, and they're taking some type of action to reopen the line to get water through to get service. Is that correct?
That's possible. I've had clients in all of these positions where the city has said, we've locked your meter, and in fact, you'll try the water, and it turns on, and they get a $75 bill. And it's happened, in fact, at my house in the wrong way, where they've turned off my water for a neighbor, for example. So I've had clients at every end of the situation, but you're right. In fact, if they were tampering with it legally, the client, they would have to go to the meter to access water. Correct.
Okay. Martha, it looks like you want to say something. I'll give you an opportunity very briefly so we can finish the testimony.
If I could, Mr. Chair, the example I think that was brought forward today, understanding that there are a number of citizens who have had issues, we actually, the City of Portland, have made changes in the billing system. I would think that recently, in fact, if folks have issues with their water, if they were to actually make a phone call and speak to folks in the billing, this example is not one that I think is actually plays out in the way that it has just been entered into record. So I would suggest if this is a major concern, we're happy to look into that, but I think it actually detracts from the bills that we're looking at today. I don't think it's
I understand. If you want to put something in writing to respond, that's fine, but we're not going to take any more time on that.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Unless there's any other questions? If not.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. For more than 10 years, I've been a member of the Board of Fish Emergency Services, and they provide temporary assistance to people that get themselves in these kind of difficulties so their power or their water isn't shut off.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, all three of you.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to be Tom Shockless, Larry Harvey, and Mark Nelson. Mr. Harvey, you can go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here today on behalf of the Consumer Financial Services. I want to apologize. I didn't really mean to be flip with my response earlier because these are serious problems, and My personal experience suggests that you get in a bad situation.
The chair didn't take anything of being flippant. I just, when you said opening remarks, usually that's for people who are proponents to the bill. And I just didn't think that you'd seen the light or whatever the proponents may say as to meaning that at that point. So I just want to make sure we got you in the order with everyone else.
And I appreciate that. That's very kind of you, Mr. Chair. Within the context, though, I wanted to make sure that the record was clear that in the last few days, on behalf of my client, we have been having serious discussions with not only Ms. Streisinger, and we're very appreciative of her time, as well as other members of DCBS, including Mr. Tatman. I have yet to meet with Angela Martin, but we've made arrangements. And the bottom line is that we did have a lengthy discussion regarding the database issue. As you know, there have been some comments and concerns expressed regarding security and so on. And I can also tell you, because of the correspondence that's come across my desk, that there are a number of payday lending businesses that have elected to leave Oregon, and I get letters every day. The intent of a proposed amendment that's being drafted right now, actually, and we're waiting to get some language back from Legislative Council, is that there would be a threshold at which the department would not need to maintain a database, particularly if it was unnecessary or not very useful or not really being of use to the department, so it's one less concern that they would have to share. And the concept is simply that based upon the Department of Consumer Business Services' own records of more than 800,000 transactions in 2005, if in fact the business is diminished in Oregon to less than 50%, then within the context of a 90-day quarter that if less than 100,000 transactions are taking place, that in fact it would leave, it's a permissive language that would leave that to the department director to not maintain the database, and that it would be an expense that wouldn't have to be incurred. Well, as soon as that language is available, we're happy to share that with you. Again, I appreciate that Mrs. Streisinger has been so gracious about taking this up with me, and I understand from Ms. Martin's testimony that she's interested in considering that as well, so we hope to be back here when you consider 2203 in a work session and give it a little bit lighter paperweight.
Thank you.
Tom? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Pruszynski. I'll try and be brief myself, too. I feel like I need to go on a record for the Community Financial Services Association of Oregon saying, although we may not have supported specific bills by Governor Kulongowski and members of the legislature, I certainly, and I know our association, applauds and supports the legislative process and the efforts that go into public service. Having said that, briefly on 2203, have two issues. One is just reiterating what has already been said. We're very concerned about a database, particularly at the socioeconomic level of the individuals that are not really being given an opportunity to support that database. It's being used by middle class and lower middle class and lower income people. I suspicion that if this database concept was being presented to middle class, upper middle class individuals, they would not find it very supportive and be very attractive to them. So I'd like to once again give some consideration to make sure that it's indeed something that the customers who utilize the services would actually like. Two is, in as much as in 2203, there's additional language speaking to Senate Bill 1105 that's to take effect July of 2007. I would invite you, based upon some insights and some suggestions, to reevaluate that at your discretion if there might be some room there for amendments made to 2203 on the basis of what DCBS is asking for now, and that content's contained in my written testimony. On House Bill 2205, if you'd indulge me, I'd like to read five sentences and then I'll be done. According to the 2005 DCBS report of activities of consumer finance companies in Oregon, 83.33% of all loans were made for a period of less than 60 days. 83.33% 0.33% of all loans were made for a period of less than 60 days. Section 1 of House Bill 2205 would require that 90% of consumer loans be for a period of 6 months or more. This is nearly the inverse of what Oregon consumers demanded, needed, and selected in 2005. This is particularly true if payday loans are eliminated as a result of Section 1, Chapter 3, Oregon Laws 2006, which restricts short-term loans under 60 days. We fear that many consumers may not qualify for longer-term loans that require credit reports and other underwriting steps, and that they may not be able to obtain credit they need. We urge the committee to amend HB 2205 to allow lenders the freedom to give consumers the flexibility to enter into loan agreements of between 61 and 180 days. And indeed, we have some concerns about the language regarding the regulatory authority of DCBS, but I understand that there has been an amendment submitted, and that's been dealt with. Appreciate your time today, sir.
Great. Thank you. Mark?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent SWEC Management today, and known as in Oregon as Northwest, or doing business as Northwest Title Loans. I was involved in the initial statutory scheme for regulating title loans in 1999. We believed at that time, and you can see that in your bill, the outline of that statutory scheme for regulation, and that went through a fairly exhaustive process within the both bodies, and we thought we developed legislation that worked. There is, as you know, over the last couple of years, there has been extensive discussion about title loans as well as payday loans, and not to denigrate the payday loan industry at all. One of the main problems with payday loans, as you discovered when you went through the last legislation, is that an individual can go and receive multiple payday loans at the same time by going to multiple stores. Title loans are a different animal. Typically, people have one car. They can only get one loan on one car. And so the opportunity for abuse where it might have occurred in payday loans is virtually not there as it relates to title loans. Tens of thousands of Oregonians use the title loan industry in this state. And I have talked to most of you, and I have said to you, if you put a 36% cap on title loans, the title loan industry will leave this state. And even as Osberg said, when you asked Mr. Chairman about in terms of what, or I think it was Senator Monroe, in terms of gambling, clearly that has been a source of use of some of these funds. But as Osberg said, they also use it to pay groceries, to pay rent, and to pay for their prescriptions. And they have no other place to go. Even as has been indicated in other forums, even the credit unions, where if in fact they provide this service, they're providing the service usually at a minimum of an APR at around 120% if you look at their fees. But I made the statement to you that we'd be out of business, Mr. Chairman, and we've had that discussion together. I want to take you to a study, and it won't take a long time with it, that the Tennessee Department of Financial Institutions conducted. And it is very, very recent. They had significant amendments to their title loan statutes that took effect in November of 2005. In February of 2006, the Tennessee Department conducted a study and found many problems with title loans. Now, that study was looking at the regulatory scheme before the adoption of the new regulatory scheme. This report it just came out, as you can see, in terms of the date of February 12th of 2007. And this report looks at the statutory scheme, new statutory scheme of title loans in Tennessee, and then does an analysis of the economics. And the reason why I'm bringing this to today, because I want to show you there is no way this industry can survive in this state at 36%, and give you some of the economics. Now, quickly, I've highlighted to try to take you through this. I don't mean to skip over particular parts. You can go back and review that. There are some critical things in here about the title loan industry prior to some of this regulation. I want you to be able to see that, but I also want you to see where it takes you. They have an interesting concept, and I bring this to you because it may be a place you want to go. They provide in their new statute for 5%, I'm reading off page 5 now, principal reduction beginning with the third renewal. In other words, the borrower must pay 5% to reduce their loan. And this is aimed at to get out of the, or to deal with the issue of perpetual debt, which is a major issue with these types of loans, and to avoid, to try to move people out of that, to solve their short-term problem, whether it be groceries or prescriptions, but at the same time to deal with the issue so they're not coming back and they're not paying off these loans. What they have there is a 2% interest fee plus a per $100 plus a $20 fee per hundred per month. So it's a 22%, but that's an APR of 256%. I want to emphasize that. That's an that translates into 64%. If you look at how that works at the bottom of page 3, the existing current law, it allows for them to pay off that loan with a 5% reduction within 22 months, or if it was a 10%, they can pay that off in 12 months. That is something that I think that you might want to look at as you look at your level of regulation. Again, I'll say several times, if your purpose is to put them out of business, then we can do that. I've got some amendments to do that. But I want to take you through this. Page 7. References the charge-off amount, $48 million, 10,933 vehicles that were repossessed. You also have a box there that gives you a little idea that about 60% of the loans are typically under $1,000. And I'll skip over in the interest of time. There are some return on equity ratios there, return on assets, which is two different ways of looking at profitability. And again, you can look at there. They run 13 to 16%. But I want to keep taking you through the document. And they've done an evaluation here. They've taken single location businesses, small, medium, and large. So they've really dissected the market because there are differences and efficiencies that would apply here. But they bring them all back together at the end when they look at profit margins. And you look at the page on page 11, they start talking about a break-even analysis. And they have initial revenue there, expenses. This is for the entire industry in Tennessee, and a composite of about 18.2, what we call profit margin expense. Going to the end of page 12, when they do this analysis of the entire market, it says it appears from this analysis that if the lenders had charged 17.6% instead of the 22%, again, these are 264 APR, they would have made just enough revenue to offset total expenses without making a profit. As noted above, the break-even rate on a title pledge agreement would have been 17.6%. A rate higher than that would have generated a profit. Anything else would result in a loss. I also didn't net income in this study is before taxes. That's also part of the study. But it is before taxes. They then come in and they take a look at, they say, okay, that's the total industry. But now they have, you know, you have some businesses have multiple businesses inside. So they've tried to isolate that and get to a break-even rate, and you'll see that on page 15 for small, medium, and large companies. When they go to the conclusions, what they're saying is that your break-even rate is around the 17.6%. And that above that, you make money. Below that, you don't. Now, at a 36% APR versus a 264% APR, which is what these fees represent, you can clearly see no one can stay in business at that rate. They can't. And again, these are not our numbers. It's Tennessee, and a fairly exhaustive study. Again, we get mixed up about some people have fees instead of an interest rate. We've had an interest rate here. But when you take those fees and you put them at $100, which is what this state does and other states do, they're at 264%. Now, a lot of people don't continue to roll over that loan and have it at that rate. But that's what the APR is. And you've set in this bill, not you, but the body, has set the 36% APR. That, you know, categorically, we'll put this industry out of business and we'll deny tens of thousands of Oregonians a place to go. And they don't have a place to go for this business. I've also provided for you the Tennessee Code, So you can see how that works. Mississippi has a code of rather than a 5% that I talked to you in terms of a prepayment per after the three loans. They have a 10% prepayment or that they require, 10% after the first month. Again, a concept for you to look at if, in fact, you want to proceed to keep this industry in business and serving each individual. Finally, you have the two amendments. In these, the First Amendment, we increase the origination fee from $10 to $20. You and I discussed that, Mr. Chair. The Second Amendment is to move back to the current language where the department had recommended changing the 7-day to or 1 day to 7 days, and that they would have to wait before they could take out another loan. These loans are needed, and people can't dictate or when that emergency is going to take place. Finally, Mr. Chairman, is, as I promised you, the last amendment. If you are going to move forward with the statutory provisions that are existing in 2204 now, and from our point of view, put this industry out of business, we'd like to ask you that you consider giving them a year, as was done in the title loan, in order they have leases, they need to phase out the business, and we would ask that you give them enough time to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Mark, before we go, I want to make sure I've got two amendments that are drafted, the A2 and the A3.
Yes.
Is there another one besides that, or just the
no.
two?
No. And we did not draft an amendment, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to remove the 36. We wanted you to consider the in your deliberations looking at that Tennessee approach of setting a cap on the fee and allowing for or requiring a prepayment so that these loans can move toward being away from emergencies and move towards being repaid in a much quicker manner.
All right. A couple of things. One, I do appreciate you getting to the committee the study from the Tennessee Department of Financial Institutions. And it's kind of like deja vu. I know I was smiling at one point because I know when we were looking at the payday loan bills, one of the concepts that we were considering was buy down on debt, requiring so much to be paid before it could be rolled over for another payment, in the sense of what I believe is a way that you actually buy down the debt where the principal does not just stay floating out there. So we'll definitely take that into consideration. The last is, I didn't see any of your representatives or any of your customers or clients, I should say, that are here, so I'm going to ask you the question. I understand that Northwest Title was actually giving away gift certificates for coffee, or if they called at least my office. I don't know if they called other offices too. I'd like to know how many gift certificates to Starbucks were given out. So if you could get back to the committee on that, and that would be wonderful. Okay. That was to call to give opposition to one of the bills that's before us.
Mr. Chairman, it was my understanding that that did occur, and it stopped rather quickly.
Well, I still like to know how many gift certificates they gave away, knowing the APR rates that were being charged. I'm not sure how that affected their profit margins.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Any other questions for or requests for the people here? Mark, thank you.
Gave out enough, Mr. Chair. We've got that other bill that when they're not redeemed, we give the money to public schools.
Oh, that's
we may want to encourage this kind of practice. I don't know.
Thank you all very much. The last person I have scheduled to give testimony today is Paul Cosgrove. If there's anyone else that wanted to give testimony that's not on the list, this is your opportunity to come up. Paul, I apologize. I do have my committee now 4 minutes over, but we definitely want to make sure you have an opportunity to put on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, and I will be brief. I have written testimony that summarizes our position, which is in favor of House Bill 2205. House Bill 2205 addresses the lending practices of conventional consumer finance companies, and that's who the members of Oregon Financial Services Association are. They are, some of them, subsidiaries of national banks with familiar names like Wells Fargo and Citicorp. Citigroup. They are also sometimes local companies that have been in business in Oregon for 70 or more years doing consumer finance loans. And these are loans that are amortized, stretched out over time, based on ability to pay, done with an expectation and evaluation of the person's income, expenses, and their ability to make those payments. The provisions of House Bill 2205 are, as Ms. Streisinger pointed out, to codify rules that were passed by the department with our support after a long work group process in the fall of last year. And we believe it's appropriate to have those good business practices embodied in 2205 in statute. We would suggest and hope that you would consider our comments and support of the bill as something important for you to consider, in that we're talking about, we're the only one up here at the moment who is talking about regulation of the loans that we make, and that's what 2205 does. In other words, other comments that other folks have made about House Bill 2205 are based on perhaps they might like to obtain this license. We're in fact the people who are operating under this license. Appreciate your consideration. There is a -2 amendment, as Ms. Streisinger mentioned. We're also in support of that amendment, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, unless, Ms. Ron, do we have anything else?
No, that's it, Mr. Chair.
The committee is adjourned. Thank you, everyone, for staying.
Brian Anderson, McKinley.